Welcome back to The Late Set from WRTI. I'm Greg Bryant.
And I'm Nate Chenin.
We're so happy to have you for an extra special edition because why? Jack DeJohnette is here today talking about a newly unearthed recording that I feel is going to change the world. Mark my words, you've never heard anything like this. It's going to be awesome. Here on Blue Note, November 22nd is the release, Forces of Nature, Jack DeJohnette, Henry Grimes, McCoy Tyner, and Joe Henderson. This is incredible stuff.
Forces of Nature, live at Slugs. It was recorded in the spring of 1966. And when word of this release entered our world, everybody flipped out.
Yeah.
But nobody flipped out more than I think you did when I first told you about this release. It's been cool to just bask in mutual enthusiasm over this one, because this is, you know, you and I have a lot of overlapping interests and tastes. I feel like this one's right in the sweet spot.
Oh, it is. It is. But before we go there, we want to let our folks know something else. As, man, this thing is over a year old now. The Late Set, this podcast, this fellowship
is a
year old.
October 2023 was when we achieved liftoff.
Isn't that something else, man? But I think we better go twice as nice because the audience is growing. And, man, we're just having to sit on our hands too long between episodes for these because we'll be in the hallway talking about this or that. Oh, man, that would be a great Late Set. We're going to up the cadence.
Yeah, we got a lot to say and we want to bring it to you.
That's exactly right.
So there we go. We are beginning now as a biweekly show, and we will continue to bring you fantastic artist conversations with people like Jack DeJohnette and Esperanza Spalding and Nubia Garcia and Joshua Redman. But we're also going to intersperse that with what I call the Greg and Nate special, which is just us talking about what's going on in the music, things that are on our mind, things that are in the culture, in the air, everything from our take on the Grammy nominations to the latest crazy thing that somebody said on social media. we'll go there.
We're going to have fun. So tell your friends. Word of mouth is our best ally. And give us a 5-star rating on your podcast provider of choice. And we want you to send us your questions. Our mailbag episode is coming up very soon, in just a couple of weeks in November. Send your questions and comments to The Late Set at this email address, editor@WRTI.org. Again, editor@WRTI.org. Your message, your audio message, or your voice memo, or your question to our inbox on Instagram. We're at WRTI Music. But we're going to get to business right now, and I want to congratulate you. Sometimes I step back from friend to fan. I loved your writing before I even met you, man, but this is a high honor, in my opinion. Nate Chenin's byline on a Blue Note record, and not just any old Blue Note record. We're talking about something that was in the can for 60 years, an archival release kept in Jack DeJohnette's stash. It's just like the folklore. And as we heard Isotope at the top of this show, already the cats are talking, man. Tell me, man, just as a fan, as a drummer, what does it mean to you to be involved in a project like this?
Well, I don't think about it in terms of the instrument. I think the obvious thing to say, which is genuine, is that it was a true honor. It was an honor just to be entrusted with this music as early as I was. I had to keep it quiet for quite a while.
How did you do that?
You were one of the only people I told. I had to share the secret with somebody. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I lived with this music for a good stretch in the spring. And I mean, I've probably listened to this album, I don't know, 100 times by now, just in an effort to really live inside of it as I was preparing to write these notes. It was an incredible privilege.
Yeah.
And the music itself, like, you can think about it, you can intellectualize it as historically important, which we'll get into it. It certainly is. But when you're in it, it's just like all of those intellectual and contextual thoughts just drop away because the music's so exciting.
Right.
I mean, it is like the most thrilling performance by a band. Mm-hmm. I put it up there with some of our favorite live Coltrane and Sonny Rollins recordings, you know? This is just like dealing on such a high level. And so really it was just like touching the live wire.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. You've snuck your label copy over to me for these notes. Man, just a great job, extensively researched. I think you make the case that Slugs is one of the most important incubators for this culture of ours, specifically in the 1960s. When you got wind that this particular lineup got together and was recorded, I mean, what kind of tingly sensations did you have? Like, where did your mind go first?
Well, the core relationship at the center of this quartet, of course, is between the two people who are credited as co-band leaders, right? McCoy Tyner on piano, Joe Henderson on tenor saxophone. And during this time period, they're just popping up on each other's recordings. And these are some of the most canonical things that either of them ever did. You know, I'm thinking of The Real McCoy and Mode for Joe, you know, these mid-60s, like, Hall of Fame recordings. And what's interesting about this gig, as I looked into the timeline, you realize they were each kind of like in a process of breaking away from something.
They were,
you know, redefining the terms of their own artistry. It hadn't been that long since McCoy Tyner stepped away from the John Coltrane Quartet. And it had only been weeks since Joe Henderson quit Horace Silver's band. And so you're looking at two of the great artists in the 1960s and beyond, but they're both kind of finding their footing as band leaders and as artists. And so what you hear in this thing, I kind of feel like they are playing like guys who have something to prove.
Yes. Yes, they are. That's imminent from note one through the rest of this recording. I am so excited for fans of McCoy and Joe and Henry Grimes and Jack DeJohnette just to hear these guys uninhibited. They may not have even known that tape was rolling. Mm-hmm. You know, it was so covert here. I want to ask you one more thing before we get into this interview. In your opinion and estimation, what does this recording do to enhance or extend the legacy of one Jack DeJohnette?
I think Jax is a legend and a career that needs no burnishing, right? I think most of us who love this music already recognize him as one of the greatest living drummers, if not one of the greatest drummers in the history of this music. I think this recording cements that reputation, like, it's ironclad. Mm-hmm. Not only that, he was 23 years old at the time that this recording was made, and the level of poise, as you'll hear Jack reminisce, he had that young energy, he had that stamina, and that the speed and the reflexes. But he also had, you know, he had come up as a pianist, he was a multidimensional thinker, and so what you hear in this recording, especially in the way that he interacts with Joe Henderson, it's so sharp. I mean, it is just right there. And it's not only responsive or reactive, it's also like steering. I think of him as steering the flow of the energy in this band. And it's, you know, this is not an avant-garde recording per se.
Right.
But it is charged with the spirit of expedition.
That.
You know what I mean? This is like some of that Blue Note era that we love from the mid-60s, where it's kind of post-bop, but it's right on the edge. It's at the door front of the new terrain, you know, the new frontier. This is like that, right? And Jack is, I think Jack with Henry Grimes, who of course is another icon of sort of the new thing and free music. The two of them know how to work within burning, forward tilt, swinging vibe, but they're bringing all of that exploration into the picture. You know what's funny? Tell me if you agree with this. I think that this recording, for whatever it does for Jack's reputation, I think it's actually going to have an even bigger impact in the way that people understand Joe Henderson.
Agreed. 100%.
So let's talk about that. I mean, we heard a bit of Isotope. Great performance. But there's a track on here that I can't wait for people to discover when this album comes out. It's the opening cut. A version of his In and Out. This track is, what is it, more than 15 minutes long?
Almost 20.
And I counted chorus by chorus mm-hmm. as Johan takes 79 choruses in his
goodness.
Solo.
Wow.
And it's every single chorus, you're like, oh my God. Oh my God. But it's also like his interaction with Jack that makes it that way.
Agreed 100% to everything that you've said. And thinking forward too about Joe, the reason that he left the Horace Silver, you know, machine, I'll really say, because Horace was churning out hits, but he also had an identity with his groups. And arguably the one guy that helped to kind of pull and push at those boundaries at the time was Joe Henderson. And I hear maybe some of that senioritis, if you will, that may have led to him departing that group. You just said weeks before this particular recording was documented. I think it makes a case for Joe Hinn. I think it makes a case for McCoy. And there's never enough Henry Grimes for my liking. So I'm happy to have these four guys documented just like this. Again, kudos to you. Kudos to Zev Feldman. Kudos to Jack DeJohnette for even being willing to have this and the appropriate estates of McCoy and Joe. I think we better get to business right now. I don't want to wait any longer. Neither should you. This is our chat with Jack DeJohnette on The Late Set.
We are so, so happy and really honored to be joined by Jack DeJohnette to talk about Forces of Nature live at Slugs. Hello, Jack.
How you doing?
I cannot even overstate this. You know, when this music, when we learned of the existence of this music and then had a chance to hear it, you should have seen Greg and me both, we were like a couple of kids on Christmas morning.
I can imagine. So was I.
Yeah. And there's something so magical about not only the music, but how this comes to us now. You've been holding on to these recordings for all these years. You know, how has this not burned a hole in your pocket during that time? You know, just holding on to this incredible thing. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I always recorded almost everything I did, and I've got over 40, 50 years of archival recordings, live mostly, and they're pretty historic. So we have some interested parties in this archive, but this particular one, Forces of Nature, happened to be recorded by another person who was Orville O'Brien, the late Orville O'Brien, and he went around recording jazz artists on spec. So he'd come in and record and then get a record deal. You know, he did Night of the Cookers and a couple of Charles Tolliver, just to name a few. But anyway, he recorded this, what you hear. And then thankfully, I thought to tell him, say, Orville, let me have a 7.5 copy of that. Because after that, the Orville passed away, and the master tapes of a lot of what he had had disappeared. Thanks to that asking to have that 7.5 copy, we got this music, you know, which is really like astounding. And even though I've heard it quite a few times, I mean, that still like excites me, and just the energy of it. And the playing, everybody's contribution to it. The whole vibe of the evening.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get into that, but I just want to point out something and share a conviction I have. At the time of this recording, which was in the spring of 1966, you were 23 years old. And Jack, I say this in all sincerity, this is some of the greatest drumming I've ever heard on record. It's so responsive, and you're directing the flow of the energy. You are just on fire. It's really, really remarkable. And, you know, Greg will say the same. We were just marveling. I mean, there's so much to get excited about with this recording, but I wanted to say up front that this is, as a document of young Jack DeJohnette, wow.
Thank you. You know, the fire of that music is, I had worked with McCoy in some trio settings. And, you know, McCoy is very intense and, you know, he likes to have intensity behind him when he plays. And, you know, Joe's the same. And then Henry just jumped right in, yeah. Took care of business. Yeah, well, there was an excitement about getting on the bandstand and see what we could get into. So that had that feeling of, you know, it might be the last time we ever play.
That's exactly what I was thinking about, the urgency with which you guys play, like it might be the very last time. And to create, like you all, Brother Jack, are creating, I think about how magnificent each of you were as timekeepers. I'm hearing these metric things and this group communication and sometimes hanging it out on the line and being willing to catch your bandmate, if you will, just requires just that deep sense of time. And I think about playing time these days. Several musicians on the scene now, we love to put the spotlight on, but generationally, I don't always hear gentlemen these days being able to play as fast as you guys play. It's almost like maybe it was a rite of passage. Can you talk a little bit about that timekeeping element and being able to relax and create when the tempos are just whizzing by?
Those were the times. I hadn't yet played with Miles yet, but I've been playing with McCoy and I played with Charles Tolliver. And those tempos were normal. They were normal, you know, yeah. So it wasn't a stretch to play them. I mean, they're hard to play if you haven't played them, experienced playing them. But keeping up the stamina, but basically to play that way, you have to be relaxed. Hmm. You can't have any tension whatsoever so that you can focus on your ideas instead of how you're dealing with it physically. Mm-hmm. And then plus, when I was in Chicago, before I came to New York, I used to practice with records. Mm-hmm. I used to practice with Max Roach, Clifford Brown. Max played some of the fastest tempos around. There's a funny story attached to that. Freddie Hubbard would come through with Art Blakey and the Messengers and Reggie Workman. And on a day, you know, during the day, we would get together and jam some with Freddie. So when I got to New York, I first came to New York, I went up to Minton's and Freddie had his quintet there. So he let me sit in, and the first tune he counted off was just one of those things. What? I mean, it was so fast, Larry had to play halftime.
Wow.
You know, for me, I jumped right in it. You know, and then after that, Freddie played a, you know, medium tempo thing. But that's what Max used to do to the guys when they came to band, was see how fast they could play, they could handle that.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was my initiation.
Can you revisit that time in your career? Because, as you said, you had already been playing with McCoy, you'd been playing with Charles. I think you had already sat in with the John Coltrane Quartet in Chicago, right? So you'd had these like very intense experiences. At the same time, the Charles Lloyd Quartet, you had recorded Dreamweaver, but it wasn't out yet. And so you were sort of on the cusp of the world getting to know your name and still kind of emerging. When you hear this recording, does it bring you back to that time when you're like just full of all this drive and in a way you're still kind of like a musician's musician? You're not known outside of the inner circle quite yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I just, my intention was just to be the best I could be. And in Chicago, because I play piano, I switched to drums and played both instruments. But I never dreamed I'd get a chance to play with all the top guys in jazz. You know, but you had to come to New York to do that, because everybody came from everywhere else to be in New York. New York was kind of the mecca for finding really, shall we say, serious players who wanted to develop their artistry by putting themselves in musical challenging situations that would help them grow. And that was my intention. That was what I came to New York for. And, you know, when I was in Chicago, I used to play a lot of jam sessions. And this is one thing they don't have anymore now, these days. for the young musicians. They really, you really have to travel to earn a living at it. That along with the Spotify really put a crimp in everybody's financial ability to earn some money. So then, you know, it was quite common. You know, everybody was eating, sleeping, drinking music. And so that's what I did. Every chance I had a chance to play, I would play, you know, jam and just take it all in, and also play with musicians that I knew that would help me grow, and we would help each other grow. Mm-hmm. You know, by the challenges we would throw at each other. You know, that was the impetus for it. Of course, later on, you know, I got the opportunity to play with Betty Carter, Abby Lincoln, and some of the top players around New York City, Bill Evans, and then Stan Getzen, and I got the call to work with Miles. So Miles had that same, playing with Miles had that same kind of intensity. Mm-hmm. You know, Miles, shall we say, illuminated that kind of vibe of being expected to play at an intense level, but also play what you don't know. Uh-huh. So every, the music is always different every night.
Brother Jack, you were answering actually the first part of my question. I appreciate that insight about being on the scene and playing and doing your best so that people know to call you. Paint the picture a little bit, if you can, though, about Slugs itself. We have so precious little documentation of Slugs in comparison with maybe, you know, recordings from Birdland or the Half Note or the Five Spot even.
I used to live around the corner from Slugs between Avenue A and B. Slugs, I think, was on 4th Street between B and C, I believe. I could just walk around and go hear some music, get gigs, work in there. Everybody used to work there. It was a soulful club, like a railroad type club, straight at a bar, and then had a bandstand, which was to the left of the club when you walked in. It was kind of like a mecca. Freddie Hubbard would come, Sun Ra would play, Blue Mitchell, Junior Cook, and Chick Corea, Al Foster, Yusef Lateef. You know, it was a hangout. It was a place. They had sawdust on the floor. Mm-hmm. And true to its names, I mean, occasionally there would be some slugfest in Slugs. Occasionally that would spring up. You know, I think the saddest part of that of Slugs was when Lee Morgan was shot.
Yes, sir.
It's really a drag because it was a .22 bullet that he got, but the emergency service took so long to get there, he bled to death.
Yeah. Mm. You know, you mentioned all the people who played, and right around the time that this recording was made, Albert Eiler also made a recording, which is one of the few that's been out for a long time, which raises a question I wanted to ask about. Here we get into terminology, but the really like swinging hard bop tradition that is so associated with Blue Note Records and was associated with Joe Henderson, that along with this exploratory spirit and the avant-garde. I mean, 1966 is a really supercharged moment for that, where the music is both like rock solid and also kind of like stretching. And I was saying to Greg, this is a space that you kind of live in, you know, like few people have mastered that, like the duality, you know. Can you speak to this recording as a document from that kind of push-pull sort of tension?
Well, let me go back some years in Chicago, mm-hmm. because I played all types of music there. And also I was present when Roscoe Mitchell, Joseph Jarman were all part of Muhal Richards Abrams' experimental band. This was before the AACM was formed, but I got a lot, learned a lot about playing free and making it make sense in Chicago. So mm-hmm. when I got to New York, I wasn't thrown by what was happening. I was just curious, you know. I remember once I was up in, they used to have the Hire Your Act, and they used to have the Jazzmobile to go around in the neighborhoods in New York. on a flatbed truck and play music in the community, you know, which was really cool. So I had played before, but then the next people around the bill was, I think it was Stanley Turrentine with Idris Muhammad, before he was changed his name. For the first time I heard Don Pullen and, what's his name? He just passed away. He became a doctor, Milford Graves. So after hearing Stan Turrentine, some swinging stuff, I thought, oh, okay, some different versions on that. And they were all up there, no tuning up, no counting off tempos. And all of a sudden, Don just nodded his head, and shit was flying. It was crazy. I mean, Milford was like a marionette playing with mallets, and fluff was flying off the mallets, and I was like, damn. And it was serious. It was serious. And then back, you know, we talk about Slugs. I went and saw Albert Eiler play in Slugs too, with Sonny Murray. And Gary Peacock used to play with Albert. I think Albert was a bit misunderstood. In fact, when guys are accused of playing free and not, you know, not studying instrument, not knowing how to play, I challenge that, because in order to play that way, you have to have discipline.
Yes, sir.
Look at Ornette Coleman. When I first heard Ornette, man, I thought it was great. And the first thing I said, there would people be arguing about whether Ornette knew how to play changes or not. And I heard them play that. Man, how are you going to play that without having gone through Bird and studied all that and then reinvent yourself another way? And that's when Ornette came out with his own way of doing that stuff. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so Slugs was like that. We had experimental bands, you know, Sun Rod there, and it was quite a historical place, which with its demise, people have forgotten about it. If it wasn't for this recording, we wouldn't be talking about Slugs now.
Mm. Very true, very true. And you were mentioning Ornette Coleman and his vocabulary. I think about these tunes that you all documented on this night at Slugs. Absolutely, there's some minor blues. There's one standard. But even in the case of these minor blues, these are original compositions. And I think about from getting the call and thinking about, this is 1966. You know, Joe Henderson's In and Out album is only a few months old, if anything. Did you guys have a chance to talk over the heads or rehearse? Or was it completely just count it off and go and decide the tunes in the moment?
Well, we had a rehearsal, but I knew most of the tunes anyway. So the music was not that difficult. We had a rehearsal sound check. But after that, it was just to go up and hit it.
Mm-hmm. In and Out is a truly remarkable performance. And I really think that, especially for the legacy of Joe Henderson, This solo that he takes, and I count it, it's just under 80 choruses that he takes on this tune. I think that it will be studied, and I think that it's going to really help refocus some of our understanding of what an incredible improviser Joe really was. And I wonder if you can talk, because you've listened to this a bunch of times, can you talk about this performance as a Exhibit A for Joe Henderson as a truly like titan of the tenor saxophone?
Yeah, well, you really get a chance to hear those capabilities of that in this. Keep in mind, we were all younger then. So, you know, we hadn't actually reached our pinnacle playing yet, but as a step forward, that was like quite a leap in confidence and, shall we say, honing or refining the quality of our improvisation, improvising, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think everybody enjoyed the feel. It was an atmosphere that we could try anything.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, you know, and it came off. So there was a trust there from everybody. So, which allowed us to have the freedom to do what we did.
Because of the presence and the unmistakable voice of McCoy Tyner, it's very easy to hear the John Coltrane Quartet as an influence in this performance, which I think was kind of like, the way to think about it might be like, that was lingua franca at that time, right? It's like everybody was listening to that band. And to have McCoy in the band, it's really crystallizing. You know, you hear how much Joe admired John Coltrane. And I can hear moments where the intensity of Elvin's polyrhythms, like that's something that you access and you know how to deploy. So was this a topic of conversation for you all? Like how present was the sound and spirit of that band on a gig like this?
I don't know, because McCoy was playing, he wasn't playing those fourth chords he was playing in McCoy. Mm-hmm. So you hear more originality from McCoy and you hear him like, playing those bass tempos, man, and the shit he was playing was like chorus after chorus. That's where he and Joe sort of parallel in the same parallel trajectory. Mm-hmm. They play chorus after chorus and they would just keep building. Yeah. So yeah, there might be a similarity of things like, for instance, I think it was In and Out, where everybody else drops out and it's just Joe and me.
Yeah.
You know, you could refer to that back to Coltrane and Elvin. Yeah. But I don't think that was intentional necessarily. It was just everybody dropped out. McCoy had been used to doing that anyway. Mm-hmm. So everybody just, Henry and McCoy dropped out. So yeah, so there's a real tightness between Joe and I on our dialogue together.
Yeah.
I really was glad that was captured, you know.
I think this is gonna shake up the world in the best way. I'm already changed by hearing it all the way through just once. And I wanna go back, Brother Jack, to the tape itself. The fact that you asked for a copy, the fact that John Coltrane had his Olatunji last concert documented on his own, Charles Tolliver making some strides as well as taking control of his own destiny or career in small and big ways. How important was that to your generation in not only documenting the music, but just assuring that your story could be told through your own lens uncompromisingly?
The way to answer that is that when I was in Chicago, I used to record everything because I recorded everything for R&D purposes. I listened to see how the group was playing and what I was playing, what I have to work on to change, to develop something I was doing that didn't lay with me the right way and I could make changes. And I strongly believe that recording things like that help you grow a lot faster. You get a immediate reflection back on what you're trying to do. So I kept that in mind, and I just would record almost everything that I did. And there's a recording with Bill Evans and Eddie Gomez and I, Resonance Records, which I recorded on a little small tape recorder, Ronnie Scott's. Through the recording technology, they would clean it up a bit, but there's a lot of music there and you hear Bill playing quite differently than normal. So it really captured that. So again, that's a testament to say recording music, you know, that say, well, okay, this might be valuable someday, but it's nice. I can go in there and pick out something and hear the history of the music.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be able to hear otherwise.
Yeah. You mentioned the history, and this is the kind of thing that I fixate on sometimes, you know, just thinking about the historical record and what we have available and the story that it tells. And we've talked about this before, I think. You can't trust a discography to tell the story of the music. It's helpful. They're signposts, but the discography only tells you so much. And what we have in this case with Joe and McCoy, okay, we've got In-N-Out. The real McCoy would come a little later. There's this kind of points on a trajectory. And I wonder if you can speak to what you think the existence of these tapes now in the world, the fact that people are going to get to hear this moment when all of the sort of pivotal energies with McCoy having just left John Coltrane and with Joe having just left Horace Silver and with you just about to go on world tours with Charles Lloyd, there's so much that's kind of like coiled in this moment. And I wonder if you can reflect on what you think this is going to do in terms of our understanding of the narrative of this music.
Well, I hope it will inspire other musicians to strive for that kind of focus and intensity. Not to say that there's quite a few or a lot of musicians, younger musicians, that, you know, already doing that in this time frame. But I think it would give them a boost, like when you get inspired and when you used to play records to get some inspiration and hear other musicians to give us some hints as to what we could do for ourselves. And so I think this will, I don't know, I won't say shake people up, but I think a lot of people will hear, they'll shift a lot. The intensity with how I was playing, you know, it was like first time I played that tape, it was like, oh shit, man, this is really important.
Yeah.
I got it. I mean, I still, when I play and listen to it, I still get that feeling again, like the music sounds fresh to me again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not boring.
Yeah.
Not at all. Not at all. And I feel the same way. As a very young child hearing you for the first time, you taught me, Brother Jack, that music is beyond notes. And we hear that term these days, spiritual jazz. You guys were playing spiritual music for sure, for me. That's how I interpret it. And I think about 23-year-old Jack DeJohnette in 1966. I was not there, but I've read a lot about 1966. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. How much were you playing for your own healing with what you had to combat in the world, just as a 23-year-old in New York City, trying to make a living, being Black in America, to be honest?
Well, I always felt music had the potential for healing, not only the audience, but helping. I say the music was a safe place, you know, like a home. That's why maybe the rest of your life is messed up or there's challenges. But with music, you had a flow. You didn't have anything blocking. If you're a musician, you like to flow and be free. That's how I felt about what the music could do, and, shall we say, artistic-wise, and in other cases, like political-wise, Max and Abby Lincoln, protesting inconsistencies of the treatment of African-American musicians. Case in point, Max was fighting to get Black classical artists in the symphonies, because that was definitely the room for us. But I mean, thanks to him, that's changed now. So, and it's still changing. Yeah. So the music gets connected to quite a few things. Unfortunately, now. In politics, the music is, I think, misrepresented in a sense of what it's used for, and without the artist's consent.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, you know. So yeah, I think again, looking forward when you play, and not looking backward. And if you look backward, you shall we say reshape what you hear into something of now, this time. Here and now.
Thank you so much for being Jack DeJohnette and for taking time out with us today on The Late Set. Thank you so much, man.
My pleasure, man. Both of you. Thanks. Keep doing what you're doing.
Will do. Thank you so much. Yeah.
You changed my life, man. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Late Set, where dreams do come true. Speaking with Jack DeJohnette about this very archival find has been a highlight for me. And man, I'm just grateful to be basking in these sounds. And I'm so excited for the world to hear this on November 22nd.
Yeah, you know, as you said, it's going to change the world. Mm. We are at that time in our show when we want to share some more good news. So this I dig.
Yeah.
Let's dig in.
Absolutely. For my pick, folks, vote. That's what I dig. Vote.
You dig democracy.
Absolutely. And keeping it in place. That's all I'm going to say about that. Make your move to the polls early if you can. Do your civic duty, please. And thank you. What do you have for us this week?
Well, I'm going to cue up a piece of music. Here we go. So that is a track titled Kamala's Dance.
Yes.
It is by the late, great trumpeter Roy Hargrove from an album titled Crisol Grand Terre.
Yeah.
Now, I should say that Kamala, in this case, is not a presidential candidate, but actually Roy Hargrove's daughter, who is a dancer and who filmed a beautiful interpretive dance in a video for this track. Mm-hmm. But the album, which came out on October 18th, is a follow-up to his Grammy award-winning album, Habana, by his Crisol band. And not only is it a follow-up, it's really a sort of deepening of this engagement that he had with Afro-Cuban music. It's fantastic. I mean, the band sounds really broken in and hitting on all levels. And this is a recording that I will return to often.
I will too, and you'll hear it on the evening jazz show here on WRTI. You've already been hearing it, as a matter of fact, thanks to you, my man, for putting me onto this a few weeks back. But it's a great recording in the lineage of one of our greatest bosses of the brass, Roy Hargrove. Man, I'm excited about coming back in 2 weeks. We don't have to wait to get back together, but we should say right here, Nate, that our mailbag episode is coming soon. And we want you to direct all of your critiques and criticisms and we want to hear from you honestly, earnestly. If you have a question about the music, a question about us individually, however you want to ask it is cool. We'll give you bonus points if you do it as a voice memo. We'll actually put you on the show. And let me give you the email address right now. editor@WRTI.org. Again, editor@WRTI.org. We want to hear from you. We want to take your questions, your comments, whatever you want to say, leave it with us, or DM us in our Instagram account @WRTIMusic.
Put us on the spot. Do your best. We'll do our best. The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. It's hosted by me, Nate Chenin, with Greg Bryant, and the show is produced by the indefatigable Alex Arif.
I like that attribute. My man, Alex. Special thanks. We want to send it out to Jack and Lydia DeJohnette, who produced Forces of Nature alongside Matthew Garrison and Zev Feldman. Thanks to Zev, as well as Jim Kurosman at Blue Note Records.
WRTI's operations manager is Joe Patty. Assistant director of production is Tyler McClure. Associate General Manager for Content and Programming is Josh Jackson, and Bill Johnson is WRTI's General Manager.
Stop by WRTI.org. You can see everything else that we're cooking up here at the station in Philadelphia and beyond, and we'll see you really soon in about 2 weeks.